So in an unexamined life, we just go with convention. We kind of just agree with what society agrees to, and we kind of go along with it. I ran across these these classic phrases, which many of us sort of automatically fill in the blank because they're kind of part of our culture, such as, like, you know, the early bird catches the worm. There was a teacher with her first and second graders who thought it would be interesting to let the kids fill out to finish these phrases. And so here are a couple of what they came up with. A penny saved is not much. It's always darkest before daylight savings time. This one is really wise. A miss is as good as a mister. And my favorite, they're none so blind as Stevie Wonder. There's something so refreshing about the out-of-the-box thinking. And really, that's what we've all been up to this week. We've really been exploring what does it mean to get out of the box of this linear, finite mind and open to reality, open to the mystery of what this life is all about. We've had some wonderful, wonderful talks this week with Tara talking about the challenges on the path of how to recognize and meet your demons as they arise. And Noli speaking so beautifully about what it means to cultivate compassion as you engage with your unfolding experience inside. And Kanda, such an awesome talk on the three characteristics of reality and how our practice really is all about seeing into the nature of reality. Tomorrow, you begin your transition from the monastery back into the marketplace. And in the meantime, it's good to sort of celebrate this practice of waking up. You know, there was a call inward to come here that you responded to. This short line from, or a little poem from St. Teresa of Avila on the interior castle. This magnificent refuge is inside you. Enter. Shatter the darkness that shrouds the doorway. Be bold. Be humble. Put away the incense and forget the incantations they taught you. Ask no permission from the authorities. Close your eyes and follow your breath to the still place that leads you to the invisible path that leads you home. You responded to that call. And I'm so inspired by your practice. Your practice has deeply informed and inspired me. We've talked a lot about suffering and the end of suffering, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit more to what it means to really know suffering and what it means to know the end of suffering and what it means to walk the path to the end of suffering. How we respond to our experience of stress, dissatisfaction, unsteadiness, and suffering. The calling to respond to that. You may recall way, way, way back when I led the first opening meditation, the instructions. And we talked about the walking practice and the device renunciation. And I thought I did a pretty good job, if I say so myself. After that, I stood up and I exceedingly mindfully folded my shawl and I placed it, draped it over my chair just perfectly. And I turned and I headed toward the door and I promptly tripped over Kanda's pillow. I thought, what is that damn pillow doing on the floor? And I realized that there are some people who need pillows for their feet to touch the floor. Luckily, I was able to laugh at myself. But sometimes I'm not able to laugh at myself in those moments. I take myself very seriously. And therein lies our suffering. One thing you can be grateful for, I think, this retreat is that no one could read your mind this week. Could you imagine if you had a speaker mounted on the top of your head just broadcasting? There are lots of definitions about meditation, but there's one in particular I think describes it to a T. It's from Stephen Levine. He said, meditation is one insult after another. But again, back to suffering and the end of suffering. Surely you have been intimately familiar with the suffering part of that. Chances are you've seen more clearly into the patterns of stress in your life, the cycles of thoughts and stories that come round and round and round. Chances are you've gotten to know the craving mind pretty well. That's endlessly planning and anticipating what's next. And chances are you've gotten to know the worried mind pretty well. The recycling of the same issues without any resolution. And the dull mind. And the aversive mind, the judging mind, the blaming mind. The mind that at times is just filled with hatred and ill will. And the sleepy mind. The mind that just numbs out. And the doubting mind. And the daydreaming mind, when you're just sitting in this kind of hypnagogic, dreamlike state. And the critical mind, the ruthless, endless critic in the background. You may have had old memories come up through the mind. And then the pain, the dull pain, the stabbing pain, the waves of pain, the piercing pain, the subsiding pain, the reappearing pain. And maybe you've also had a taste of the end of suffering. One retreatant shared how when he first arrived and he was going into silence and he just saw this judging mind. And someone walked by and he thought, wow, nice shoes. He thought, where did that come from? And by the end of the retreat, he was sharing how much love he felt for everyone. Something falls away over time. So we're training ourselves to meet what we find with loving presence, with compassion and kindness. And chances are you have felt things at times feel very, very tight, begin to shift and soften. Maybe you feel a little more here than you were 5 days ago. Maybe you're holding a little bit less stress in your belly or your jaw or the back of your neck. Maybe you've had this amazing capacity when you reflect on conflict to kind of spontaneously do a role reversal and imagine what the other person is feeling or what the other person needs. Maybe you're better rested than you were 5 days ago. Maybe you don't quite believe every thought the way you used to. Maybe you've had some random happy attacks. I've heard they've happened. And I think it's safe to say that you won't know the benefit of your time here until weeks and weeks later. When I did my first month-long retreat, there was just revelations and lots of insights. And when I went back a few years later, I was ready for the same. And it was kind of a meh experience, you know, no big revelations. And I came home and I re-engaged into life. And it was maybe a month or so later that Tara said, you are less stressed. And then when I paused and I realized that there was a clench that wasn't as clenched. And it was a profound revelation that something fell away. you won't know what fell away. Sometimes when we practice insight meditation, there are these wonderful cognitive insights, but quite often not. Just the sense that something is letting go. So, what an amazing week. I'd like to recommend you might just lift your right arm up, bring it over, cross the body, and pat yourself on the shoulder. Amazing job. Amazing job. What courage it takes to stay in this practice. Not just to stay, but to sense the suffering and the stress and the dissatisfaction and actively turn toward it. To actively, when you can, put your head in the mouth of the demon, as Tara described. To reflect on what it means to cultivate a heart that can hold your experience. And the courage to look ever closely at these three marks of existence, these qualities of reality. What kind of maniac would sign up for a retreat like this? And so when we talk about suffering, Ajahn Chah, who we refer to as one of the teachers in this lineage, he said the following. He said, there are two kinds of suffering. The suffering which leads to more suffering, and the suffering which leads to the end of suffering. The first is the pain of grasping after fleeting pleasures and aversion to the unpleasant, the continued struggle of most people day after day after day. The second is the suffering which comes when you allow yourself to feel fully the constant change of experience, pleasure, pain, joy, and anger without fear of withdrawal. This leads to inner fearlessness and peace. And so there is this celebration of our relationship to dukkha, to know and see dukkha more clearly. Someone once asked, well, what goes on in those retreats? The best description is dukkha, dukkha, dukkha breakfast, dukkha, dukkha, dukkha lunch, dukkha, dukkha, dukkha dinner. So when you reflect on the suffering, the inner suffering that you have witnessed this week, when you could feel the rope burn of holding on, and you might just sense how you have related to it, how your relationship to it may have changed over these days. The capacity to be curious, the capacity to name it rather than simply cringe and withdraw. It's extraordinary. And how much outer suffering have you witnessed this week? In the groups, of hearing from others who are articulating just what they're noticing at the edge of awareness. To me, that time of articulation and deep listening and in the small groups it's so sacred, such a sacred part of our practice together. To have someone describe an inner unfolding that might articulate what you're going through, but maybe not quite aware of it. Or to recognize someone's suffering as your own. It's one of the things I most savor in these retreats, that sense of spiritual friendship. And it's why when I stumbled into an ashram for lunch, I stayed for 24 years. To have the power and the potency of this rarefied air to share this space together. There's just nothing like it. The courage to share, to recognize what is present and what is arising in awareness, to name it, to make room for it, it's extraordinary. And you may have noticed that in the listening in our groups, that it not only expands your heart, but it expands your sense of identity. To see yourself in others and others in yourself is really the power of healing. It breaks us out of the trance of separation. It breaks us out of that, the sense of feeling that our suffering is unique. And as Werner Erhard, the founder of EST, said, 5 billion people thinking they're unique is not unique. And there's a wonderful line that says, resolve to be tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant with the weak and wrong. Sometime in your life, you will have been all of those. Our capacity to recognize self and other and other in self. And by the way, that's not a quote from the Buddha. I checked it out on fakebuddhaquotes.com. And the byline to that site is, I can't believe it's not Buddha. So you're familiarizing yourself with the clench, with that primal clench of something's wrong. Something's wrong with me, something is wrong out there. And we get to know this, we get to see it, we get to see it form, we get to see how we grasp, and we get to see the possibility of letting go. It's been said that this path can be summarized in two words. Let go. When I was in my 20s in college, I was living on a farm with some fellow meditators, and we were also managing a 1,000-acre farm and a big 500-head livestock operation. This was in the Midwest, and there was a neighbor of ours. His name was Jim, and he was this crusty old guy. He lived in a mobile home. He ran his little farm. He was a farmer, a tinker. He was also a chain smoker and a philanderer, and he always had a six-pack of RC Cola next to him wherever he went. And he used to really enjoy coming down to our farm. And he had really no social manners whatsoever. Now, his way of connecting, he had this one line he used to say. He used to say, if I had a dog as ugly as you, I'd shave its butt and teach it to walk backwards. He talked out of the corner of his mouth and always had the cigarette. And Jim started getting heart attacks. And so we kind of took him in, and we'd invite him down for dinner, and we were all vegetarians, and he would endlessly make fun of us. But he kept showing up for meals. One day he called, and he said he'd had another heart attack, his fifth heart attack. And so John and I drove up to his mobile home. We had a big old station wagon. And had him in the back seat, and John was driving, and I was kind of like leaning over the back seat, and he was talking in the same kind of crusty way about, you know, what he wanted done and that sort of thing. And then our eyes were kind of locked. I couldn't really hear what he was saying, so I was trying to really make connection. And then suddenly this look of terror came over his face, and his eyes filled with blood. And as we're driving down the highway, you know, 90 miles an hour, I was trying CPR in the backseat of a station wagon, which doesn't work. But I kept, and we were maybe 10 minutes away, and I kept screaming, Jim, take a breath, take a breath. And there was no breath for a long time. And then suddenly, a breath came, and his eyes cleared. And I do not feel that I am making this up. our eyes were locked the entire time, that when he came back, there was this overwhelming sense of love. The only way I can describe it is love. And he took a few more breaths, and I was frantically wanting him to take another, but they got longer and longer. And at some point, there was one last breath, and that was it. For me, as I've just sat with that experience over the years, it was such a profound witnessing of what it means to let go. This guy and his crusty, hardened personality all let go. And what came back, what kind of re-arrived, was this incredible sense of being held in light and held in presence. That's what we've signed up for. There is what I refer to as this horrible prayer from yoga philosophy that says, Lord, burn what can be burned, drown what can be drowned, and cut what can be cut. For I want to know what it is that cannot be burned, cannot be drowned, and cannot be cut. Every time you let go of something you're holding on to, you are releasing into something ineffable. What is that that you are releasing into? And so in our practice, we're letting go all the time. Every time you find your mind off and you recognize it, you just let go of that story. You're letting go of your story. You're letting go of your attachments. You're letting go of your dreams. We all know that we have to let go of this body. We all know that everyone that we hold dear is going to fall away in no particular order. We all know that we even have to let go of ourselves as a meditator. And this gives us these glimpses. Sometimes they're glimpses. I like to think sometimes that this is a practice of glimpses. To know in ourselves that all conditioned things will fall away. To know that whatever we hold on to, yes, it will give us rope burn. Whatever we can let go of opens a space. If we let go a little bit of space. If we let go a lot of space. And as Khanda articulated so beautifully, when you reflect on who you are, you recognize there's a lot of you that is born of causes and conditions. Every one of us had a mother and a father. Our thoughts, our beliefs, our emotions, they're all subject to change. And the question is, given that everyone you know will fall away in no particular order, given the reality that this flesh unit you have is going to fall away at some point, how do you live? How do you want to live your life? There are some philosophies that say this world is filled with illusion. Don't even mess with it. Because as soon as you engage, you're going to get caught in the trance. All the traditions that have you disengage. As when I had a celibacy vow for many years in the ashram, we used to say, no relationship problems. No car problems. And again, this philosophy, you see it in every tradition. the monks and nuns, the priests, you know, don't engage. So what is the deal here? Is it to let go of all of your attachments and once you've all let go, just get out of Dodge? Or does it have something to do about living in that knowing of reality and choosing to live fully in your life, to be fully present in your relationships, in your responsibilities, in your commitments, to live in that knowledge of how much we share collectively? And this introduces the whole concept of the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva ideal. The bodhisattva, one definition, is one who is bound for enlightenment. A bodhisattva is not someone who is fully liberated, but it is someone who vows to undertake service as a vehicle for awakening. Not withdrawing from the world, but engaging in the world while remembering those three marks of existence. Andrew Harvey, back in the 80s, made this statement that I really seen to be true. He said, "We're moving from an age of gurus to an age of wounded healers." And certainly as we've seen all the kind of the world gurus crumble, and as we've seen, I like to think that somehow just the consciousness, if we are evolving, that there's a certain consciousness that is no longer tolerating power over other. That as we step into the world, we recognize, yes, we are wounded, and yes, we are healers. That we can wake up and wake each other up through compassion and service and love. So what does that look like? And I wanted to share this this piece. It's called The Good Conductor at Peterborough. One act of kindness that befell British writer Bernard Hare in 1982 changed him profoundly. Then a student living just north of London, he tells the story to inspire troubled young people to help deal with their disrupted lives. The police called at my student hovel early evening, but I didn't answer as they thought they'd come to evict me. I hadn't paid my rent in months. But then I got to thinking, my mom hadn't been too good, and what if it was something about her? We had no phone in the hovel, and mobiles hadn't been invented yet, so I had to nip down to the phone box. I rang home to Leeds to find my mother was in hospital and not expected to survive the night. "Get home, son," my dad said. I got to the railway station to find I'd missed the last train. A train was going as far as Peterborough, but I would miss the connecting Leeds train by 20 minutes. To this day, I won't hear a bad word said about British Rail. I bought a ticket home and got on anyway. I was a struggling student, and I didn't have the money for a taxi the whole way, but I had a screwdriver in my pocket and my bunch of skeleton keys. I was so desperate to get home that I planned to nick a car in Peterborough, hitchhike, steal some money, something, anything. I just knew from my dad's tone of voice that my mother was going to die that night, and I intended to get home if it killed me. "Tickets, please," I heard as I stared blankly out the window at the passing darkness. I fumbled for my ticket and gave it to the guard when he approached. He stamped it, but then he just stood there looking at me. I'd been crying, had red eyes, and I must have looked a fright. "You okay?" he asked. "Of course I'm okay," I said. "Why wouldn't I be? And what's it got to do with you, in any case?" "Well, you look awful," he said. "Is there anything I can do?" "You could get lost and mind your own business," I said. That'd be a big help. I was not in the mood for talking. He was only a little bloke, and he must have read the danger signals in my body language and tone of voice. But he sat down opposite me anyway and continued to engage me. If there's a problem, I'm here to help. That's what I'm paid for. I was a big bloke in my prime, so I thought for a second about physically sending him on his way, but somehow it didn't seem appropriate. He wasn't really doing much wrong. I was going through all the stages of grief at once: denial, anger, guilt, withdrawal, everything but acceptance. I was a bubbling cauldron of emotion, and he had placed himself in my line of fire. The only other thing I could think of to get rid of him was to tell him my story. Look, my mom's in the hospital dying. She won't survive the night. I'm going to miss the connection to Leeds at Peterborough. I'm not sure how I'm going to get home. It's tonight or never. I won't get another chance. I'm a bit upset. I don't really feel like talking. I'd be grateful if you leave me alone, okay? Okay, he said. Sorry to hear that, son. I'll leave you alone then. I hope you make it home in time. Then he wandered off down the carriage back the way he came. I continued to look out of the window at the dark. 10 minutes later, he was back at the side of my table. Oh no, I thought, here we go again. This time, I'm going to really rag him down the train. He touched my arm. Listen. When we get to Peterborough, shoot straight over to platform 1 as quick as you like. The Leeds train will be there. I looked at him dumbfounded. It wasn't really registering. Come again? I said stupidly. What do you mean? Is it late or something? No, it isn't late, he said defensively, as if he really cared whether trains were late or not. No, I've just radioed Peterborough. They're going to hold the train up for you. As soon as you get on, it goes. Everyone will be complaining about how late it is, but let's not worry about that. You get home, and that's the main thing. Good luck and God bless. Then he was off down the train again. Tickets, please. Any more tickets? I suddenly realized what a top-class, fully-fledged idiot I was and chased him down the train. I wanted to give him all the money from my wallet, but my driver's license, my keys, but I knew he would be offended. I caught him and I grabbed his arm. I wish I had some way to thank you, I said. I appreciate what you've done. Not a problem, he said again. If you feel you need to thank me, the next time you see someone in trouble, you help them out. That will pay me back amply. Tell them to pay you back the same way, and soon the world will be a better place. I was at my mother's side when she died in the early hours of the morning. Even now, I can't think of her without remembering the good conductor, that late-night train to Peterborough. My meeting with a good conductor changed me from a selfish, potentially violent hedonist into a decent human being. But it took time. I've paid him back 1,000 times since then, I tell young people I work with. And I'll keep on doing so till the day I die. You don't owe me nothing, nothing at all. And if you think you do, I'd give you the same advice the good conductor gave me. Pass it down the line. That's the Bodhisattva in action. You know, we live in such a time of stress and suffering in our world. I was with an interesting conversation with someone. Is suffering more now than it was? And someone said, you know, when I was a kid, we were trained how to duck and cover under our desks in case of a nuclear attack. So I don't know if that's less stressful or more stressful. But stress and suffering have always been part of our human condition. And it certainly seems when we look around tremendous anxiety, physical suffering, the stress on the planet, our cultural suffering. How do we respond? I'd like to offer a short reflection. If you like, you can close your eyes. And as you bring your awareness to your breath, if you would, bring into mind just one person that you know right now who's struggling. You might just take a few moments to draw this person closer. You might take a moment to sense if you can visualize them. Imagine what they're wearing, the quality of light. Recall their voice. And as you hold them in awareness, is it possible to begin to sense what you feel on the inside as you simply reflect on their struggles? And in your own way, in these moments, you might offer them metta. Sensing the quickening of the heart in response to this person's suffering. Sensing in your own way if you could offer how much you care about their suffering. To hold it in loving presence. Gently deepening your breath. And if you like, in your own time, you can open your eyes. Or you can remain with them closed. That's totally fine. Noli spoke of the quivering in response to suffering. And it speaks to this arising of bodhicitta, of both wisdom and compassion. When we look solely through the lens of wisdom, we can view life through the lens of karma, cause and effect. It can be quite cold. When you see someone who is struggling, you can see how they created their suffering. Looking solely through that lens has a quality of wisdom, but there's no heart. At the same time, when we respond with the heart without wisdom, we find ourselves trying to learn someone's lessons for them. And finding that balance is part of the art. To understand that we're all learning our lessons, and at the same time to open and extend our hearts. One of the big upsides of this practice is you become more sensitive. And there's also a really big downside to this practice. You become more sensitive. And it takes tremendous courage to stay present. Ram Dass, who was a pivotal person in my life and set me on my path long, long time ago with his book, Grist for the Mill, wrote another book which kind of sums up his whole life. And the title of the book is How Can I Help? Part of our response to suffering is calling on that question. How can I help? In the Bodhisattva tradition, there is a vow. And the classic vow goes like this. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. When we truly open to the suffering of this world, it truly is numberless and inexhaustible. How can we possibly end all suffering? And yet there's something profound about the call to be awake in the world. Truly a powerful, transformative practice to stay present to the suffering and to respond to the suffering. And yet, that path has all kinds of challenges. I wanted to speak to a few of those. I find myself at times overwhelmed with what's going on in our society right now. And it brings up a number of reactions. Part of it is sort of there's a deep sadness, kind of a despair. It's kind of an anarchist quality that comes up of really deep anger. I was raised a Quaker, and during the Vietnam War as a young teenager, and a lot of socially active Quakers. And I'd never been around so many angry pacifists in my life, where the anger and the outrage was so palpable. And yet, even then, I could sense that there was an ineffectiveness to that anger. Anger is energy, and you can get a lot done with anger. But you can get a lot more done with compassion. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. So, a few things about stepping onto the path of responding to inner and outer suffering with compassion. The first is to fill your cup. You know what it's like when your cup is full and overflowing. Those wonderful moments where you just feel so good, it's impossible not to be nice to everyone. And I've certainly had many people over the years say, you know, this meditation yoga stuff, it's so narcissistic. It's so self-absorbed. But my sense is, it's actually our individual responsibility to fill that cup so it's overflowing. Because when you're engaged in the world, when it's overflow, there's a quality of joy to it. And you know what it's like when you're on fumes. And so caring for yourself. And one of the most painful things that I see are people who are in the role of caregiver who can't fill their cup. Quite often the attention is on the person suffering and the caregivers tend to fall by the wayside. So how do you fill your cup? A daily ritual, a daily practice is critical. And along those lines, it's very important to be aware of compassion fatigue. when you simply can't be with the suffering in the world. Have you ever noticed how when you get a fundraising letter for, let's say, kids in the third world who are suffering, how in the letter or on the envelope, they only show two or three kids? Because what they found through market research is if they show you 100 kids, you're overwhelmed and you're not going to respond. But if you see one or two, then the heart can kind of stay open. And it's really, really critical to recognize when it's too much. Just as we practice RAIN, of recognizing what's there, and then the deep inquiry, can I be with it? And to listen deeply to that question, because sometimes you can't. You don't have the firepower. Or you need to rest. You need to fill your cup so that you can respond from a rich and full place inside. Another element is to really sense, how do you best serve? When my father was at the end of his life in an Alzheimer's unit, I was so amazed by the caregivers, and I was having a conversation with one of the caregivers, and she was telling me about the different jobs she had, and she said, and then I found my true work here. And I felt such a profound opening of my heart that for her, that was her way of serving. And she was so fulfilled in that role. Many years when I moved down to D.C., I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I remember Tara was saying, well, here's something that might be interesting. Here's a program of teaching mindfulness to people who are incarcerated with severe addiction issues. And it could be an opportunity to bring mindfulness to this population, and they're exploring recidivism rates, and you could publish a paper and so forth. I thought, yeah, that could be really good. And then the more I sat with it, the more I realized that I don't really know that world. I couldn't be as effective in that world as someone else who really knew that world from the inside. So it's such an important question to ask yourself, how can you help? Who do you do your best work with? How are you called to serve in the world? And part of this balance of the inevitable overwhelm with suffering, when we naturally shut down, is to recognize there are two sides to every coin. That there are times when you absolutely need to close down, to find a way to fill your cup so you can re-engage. But it's so important to remember to re-engage. I find these lines really helpful. There is so much going on in our world today that makes us want to close down and not see and not hear. It's easy to shut down in the face of suffering, but I think that is the greatest danger of our time. The greatest peril is not nuclear war weapons, not climate change or the poisoning of seas and soil and air, not the impoverishment of more than half the world's population, nor the murderous genocidal wars flaring up. It's not the disappearance of cultures or the extinction of species. The greatest danger is the deadening of our hearts and minds. It arises not from indifference, but from fear. We fear we can't stand it if we take it all in. Finding ways to fill your cup, being aware of when it's too much, being aware of re-engaging yet again to risk what it means to be alive in this world. Another element is to be aware of role models. And when I look at the icons of service, the modern bodhisattvas, so much of their service came out of the deepest wounds. Mahatma Gandhi thrown off a train for the color of his skin. absolutely dejected, determined to use that to transform his heart and transform the world, which he did. Nelson Mandela, tortured, determining in the midst of that pain to find a way to love his torturers and to invite them to his inauguration. Martin Luther King, who, after his house being firebombed, sat absolutely dejected and overwhelmed. And something inside told him to keep going, to take what would be naturally be hatred and ill will, somehow converting that into compassion. Anger has a certain degree of effectiveness in the world. When we can transmute that into compassion and wise action, it is a true force. And so the question becomes, as you move back into your life, what are the next steps? As you look to transforming the inner world and being a transformative agent, stepping into that role of waking up in the world, not withdrawn from the world. As you reflect on this, this may be a time of filling your cup, of consciously stepping back. It may be a practice of bringing more kindness and compassion into your inner circle, to your family. It might be transforming your workplace to a place that's more kind. It might be being a voice for those who don't have a voice, such as the oppressed or children or animals. It might be doing an inventory of your life and reflecting on how you could live lightly and do less harm. It might be marching. It might be writing letters. It might be quickening your impulse to respond to the suffering of those around you, to make that phone call when you naturally might not. I'd like to close with a little reflection as you sense this moment and the year ahead. As you close the eyes and deepen the breath, you might sense in your own way this journey of these days, how much more intimately you have become aware of that clench of suffering. Of what you have seen in your own conditioning. And you might reflect on what has fallen away. And sensing for yourself what it means to be awake, to see more clearly into the nature of what is real. And what it means for you to cultivate a heart that can hold this world. And as you reflect on stepping forward into your relationships, your responsibilities, your commitments, what calls you? What enlivens you? What would you most need to live as fully as you feel called How can you help from a place of fullness as part of this transformational journey? Awake, alive, and engaged. In these final minutes, you might take some time to reflect on the fruit of your practice. Offering the merit, offering the fruit of your practice to yourself. Can you imagine your path filled with a greater sense of ease? Guided by this awakening of wisdom, the awakening of heart. And can you imagine letting this offering extend out to those in your most inner circle? May these beings receive the benefit of the fruit of your practice. Letting this radiate out to those you work with, those you live with, those you casually see in your daily life. May these beings receive the fruit of your practice. Radiating out to those in this hall, those who are walking this path with you. And like a star in the night sky with the light radiating out in all directions without discrimination, imagine you could offer the fruit of your practice out to all beings in all directions. And as you offer it out beyond the furthest star, can you simultaneously offer it to each cell of your body? Thank you for your kind attention.